Well, hey guys, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today we have a really fun and interesting conversation that we're going to play for you. We got to sit down with Keith Ulick, who is a television film critic, but you know him best as the Paley guy, the lucky guy who got to sit down with David and Jillian and give us probably the greatest interview, right?
Yeah.
I think most people would argue that he was the best moderator, gave us the best David and Jillian interview. And he was just a delight to talk to. And we are definitely going to have him back in the future. But before we get to that great conversation, we have some tweets of the week.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These are in response to our most recent mythology episode about Blessing Way and Paperclip. And lots of great tweets in response to that from Jessica. Jessica says, hip hip hooray! That came around so fast. Paperclip was near the apogee of my X-File life because I went off to university and lost track of the series. Because back then there was only one public TV in residential college and no streaming devices. Such a clever, rip-roaring episode. Right, Jessica? That was the way things were for me when I was going to university, too, which was pre-X-File, so it didn't interfere with my X-File viewing, personally. But yeah, if you wanted to watch TV, you had to watch what everybody else wanted to watch, and you had to remember when it was on and what was happening. So I feel you, Jessica. So I'm glad that you're able to enjoy Paperclip now. From Christy. Christy says, Loved this episode. Thanks, Annie and Jen. I've always thought Scully assumed Melissa would be okay because Scully believed Skinner was there to kill her. Since the killer was with her, no one would be in the apartment. She didn't think or have time to check on Melissa with Mulder back. Christy, I feel like Christy has changed my life with this insight, actually.
Yeah,
this is such a good insight. Because we talked about this on the episode, that I was kind of mildly disturbed that Scully seemed not at all concerned about Melissa's safety and just waltzed off the Skinner and with the knowledge that Melissa was coming to Scully's apartment. But what Christy's point makes perfect sense.
Because she was afraid of Skinner. Like, Skinner was the person she was suspecting. That's actually, I mean, we knew that, but for some reason, my brain didn't make that connection. That's a really great point.
She was convinced. She was convinced that Skinner was the threat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And once she saw the threat, it's like, okay, well, probably what Scully's actually thinking is, let me get in the car and get him away from my apartment building.
Exactly. In her mind.
Just to get him away from Melissa.
She's saving Melissa in her mind.
Yes. I don't know why I didn't figure it out that way.
I love it.
Thanks, Christy, because it really just makes me feel better about that whole scene. And I love the whole sort of Anasazi trilogy, so anything that makes me love it even more, very much appreciated. So thank you, Christy. From Kathy G, Kathy says, Mulder's vision in The Blessing Way is interesting to me. Bill calls Mulder the life to which I gave life, which suggests Bill doesn't know CSM is Mulder's biological father, unless it's not really a visitation, but Mulder's subconscious at work. That could answer the Samantha question, too. Mulder wants to continue his quest, so that's what he hears in his vision. And I really believe Mulder thinks in purple prose, so that's what he would hear, even if it's not how Bill and Deep Throat would talk. Okay, that may be a stretch, but I love the purple prose. Fair point, Kathy.
Love it.
That's a great explanation, actually, for that whole sort of, like, why are they talking like that situation, that the whole thing is just an extension of Mulder's mind.
Yeah, this actually made me think of the parallels between this and One Breath also, which I know we discussed. But, like, was Scully really having a visitation with her father, or was that just something that she was hallucinating in her sort of in-between state? I mean, I never really thought about it before, because I guess it, at the end of the day, I guess it doesn't really matter. It's the, it's one of those things that, like, the truth was delivered regardless. But with this scene, as Kathy points out, that, like, the hope of the real problem we have with this scene is him saying that Samantha isn't there or whatever. And that actually makes a lot of sense coming from Mulder's subconscious, like his subconscious desire to find her. I really love that. I really love
it. Yeah, I really like that idea, too. And it also adds some value to those scenes, which honestly, I would just cringe every time it came on. But if we think of it as sort of Mulder's subconscious, then there's value in the scene in the sense that we're getting insight into Mulder's motivations and thoughts and all of that. So it provides us some interesting character insights in that sense. So I like that idea a lot, actually.
Yeah. We're just putting out fires all over the place today, huh?
Yeah, well, the listeners are. So thanks, listeners. Speaking of which, Foxlove had an interesting theory. Foxlove says, Foxlove is convinced that it was Luis who shot Melissa because, as Foxlove says, Krycek seems annoyed and that Luis shot the wrong person.
Yes.
So I think that is an also really interesting point, because Krycek does seem kind of annoyed in that scene, doesn't he?
Yeah.
At the scene of the shooting.
That's actually a very good point and a really nice piece of evidence leaning in favor of Luis Cardinal being the shooter.
Yeah.
Even though I still think the shot comes from the wrong side of the room. And it's possible that maybe Krycek is just like, oh, man, what'd you do? Like, he's just trying to blame it for no reason.
Yeah, it's possible he's trying to make it look like it was Luis's fault.
Yeah, or maybe they both fired and Luis hit her. I don't know. But I think that's actually, this is a really good point, and I do think that's actually a really good evidence in favor of Luis being the shooter. So nice catch.
I think it is, too. And just the fact that Luis is even in the room, like, narratively, why even put him in the room if not to at least give the impression that there's a good chance he could be the shooter? Otherwise, it could have just been Krycek. They just had Krycek shooting Mulder's dad. So
yeah, I'm surprised.
Shooting Melissa. But for some reason, they wanted to make sure that we couldn't blame Krycek for everything.
Yeah. And I'm sort of surprised by that, because I think that it would have been more interesting if Krycek killed them both.
You know,
rather than some rando guy that we only see again, like, in one episode.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I mean, and he's not even really scary. He's not a good character. He's not an interesting character. He's just kind of gone. And then Melissa died, like, because this guy shot her. I mean, at the end of the day, as terrible as this sounds, I mean, I would rather have been like, well, at least Krycek shot her. That's kind of cool. But, you know, it's not.
She had the honor of being murdered by Krycek, at least.
By somebody that mattered. I don't know.
Well, I agree. Yeah, I've always thought the whole Luis Cardinal thing was odd. Like, why? I often forget he even exists. And people would mention Luis Cardinal, and I'm like, who was he again? And it's just a weird addition to the narrative to have him even there.
I mean, but I get that, like, having him shoot Mulder's father and then Scully's sister, like, in the next episode is a little bit much. But still, at the end of the day, maybe that was the decision. Like, maybe that was, like, well, we can't have Krycek do both. We got to have let's give him a little partner. He's got a little buddy.
He's got a little partner.
Yeah.
Weird, interesting insight as well from Foxlove. So thank you. Everyone's got such really good ideas that I'm finding really, really interesting and insightful.
I really love this about the mythology series, about what we're doing here and like moving our way through it and trying to sort of piece it together and figure it out. And I love all the listener input is helping us do that too. And I think that's great.
It really is. And helping other listeners, I dare say, sharing the love. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate that. You know, here we are 20 odd years later, we're making new progress with understanding the mythology, which is always a wonderful thing.
Yep.
From Lynn. Lynn said, Jen, thank you for pointing out the error in Napier's constant. As a math geek, this has bugged me forever. I've never, not once, heard it referred to by that name anywhere else. But I guess Napier's constant does sound interesting and dramatic, so I'll let it slide. Anyway, your insights were fantastic, as always, and I enjoyed this episode. Keep up the great work, guys. Thank you, Lynn.
Well, nobody likes a math geek, Lynn.
I love math geeks. I live for math geeks. I'm not really a math geek, but I love the theory. So
I love
thanks,
that somebody
Lynn,
else. Yeah, I love that someone else shared your frustration, Jen.
Yeah,
I appreciate that.
That makes me feel good.
Yeah.
From Amanda. Amanda says, quoting one of us, I suspect it was probably me, quote unquote, just the right amount of confused is how I feel about every mythology episode. Shoulder shrug emoji. Yes, Amanda, you and I, it's all about being just the right amount of confused.
Yeah.
Because you are supposed to be a bit confused. You're not supposed to totally understand. It would be boring, right?
Exactly.
You have to stay just confused enough to still think there could be answers and that you still feel invested in it. That's the right balance.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me at some point, I became the wrong amount of confused with the mythology the first time around. So I'm hoping I stay on the right side of the line this time. Time will tell.
Yeah.
A little note from Pharmaceutical, just saying, thanks for the Twitter handle praise, which we did gave in our last round of tweet reading. But sure enough, it originated in Gillian Anderson's chaotic brain, a blooper from Sanguinarium, I think. And indeed, it is from Sanguinarium. I had to kind of double check out. And Pharmaceutical included the blooper clip. I don't think I had seen that before. It is very funny. She can't stop saying pharmaceutical.
Did we retweet that? If we didn't retweet,
I think we did.
Okay, if we didn't retweet that, I'm gonna.
I don't know, but we should. Yeah, it'll be there on our Twitter account. So check it out.
I just looked and it is retweeted now. So
beautiful.
We're good.
Thank you. Thanks, Annie.
Everyone can enjoy the blooper. It's fantastic.
Pharmaceutical. It's so funny. Now I'm going to do it every time I'm supposed to say the word pharmaceutical in real life. Luckily, I don't have a job where I have to say it that often. So that's a relief. We got a message from Anna. Hi, Anna. Anna says, hello, hello. I just wanted to say your podcast is absolutely lovely. Oh, thanks, Anna. It kept me entertained and awake for 8 hours of driving this weekend. And not only are you such likable and funny hosts, but the arguments and analyses you brought up had me talking along in my car. Case in point, I'm firmly in Annie's camp that never again is the best. And I have thoughts.
Yes.
Thoughts. Scully's tattoo. Long story short, I've listened to half a dozen eps and I can't wait to get through more. Thanks, Anna. Thank you. And welcome as a new listener. I'm glad that we could keep you company on that ridiculously long drive. I mean, sometimes I feel like our episodes maybe go a little bit long, but when you're on an 8-hour drive, I'm thinking a 2-hour podcast episode just goes by in a flash.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks, Anna.
Yeah, that is awesome. We're here for you on your long car rides and on any other chore you may have to undertake, or anytime you just want to unwind and pretend that the outside world isn't there. So thank you for tweeting at us. And please continue to do so and to enlighten us about anything you can think of. If you think the point has been made before, there's a good chance it has not. And if it has, I may never have heard it before. So please keep sharing your insights with us. We love hearing from you guys all the time. So join us on Twitter at XFD Podcast, and we'll look forward to hanging out with you there.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
Well, welcome, Keith. Thanks for coming on to X-Files Diaries.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, Keith, as most listeners would know, Keith Ulick, right? Did I pronounce that correctly?
Keith Ulick. Yes. Okay. You got it.
Most of our listeners will know you as the quote-unquote Paley guy, but that's obviously not all you do. Would you like to sort of introduce yourself and let us know what you're up to?
Of course. And I mean, if to the fandom, that's all I do, I mean, what an honor for that to be a thing that I do. But I'm a writer and mainly film critic by trade. I basically have my own site, which the main site now is kind of a Substack, which is just it's called All Parentheses, which is a site that I named after a Mark Rappaport video essay. And one of his, I forget which one exactly, but one of his essay films, he makes a lot of parenthetical statements, and he said something. He said, "Here's another parentheses, but isn't it all parentheses?" You know, and I just thought that was such a great observation. I was like,
awesome.
And I was just because he has such a digressive way of speaking, and you might find that I do too. So maybe that's why I grabbed.
Well, Keith, you might find that Jen and I do too.
Awesome. Yes.
This is a very digressive land.
Yes. So anyway, that's kind of my main site, All Parentheses. And then I have a Letterboxd account as well. And so I've been doing things between those. I do professional writing. I've written for Hollywood Reporter, although pandemic-wise, I mean, maybe everyone can understand that certain jobs have gotten less. There's been less work out there. So that's, I think, kind of where that is right now. Although I do have a monthly column in a, I think, Philadelphia paper called Icon that I just do four capsule reviews. And but my history, main gig I had was Time Out New York for 4.5 years. Where I was a staff film critic there. And I've been doing film criticism since middle school. And that always kind of segued with TV criticism as well, because I kind of see motion picture art as kind of encapsulating film, TV, and the gallery, actually. A lot of people don't talk about gallery art. And, I think there's a lot of really wonderful gallery art that also adheres to motion picture structures and stuff. So I try to cover all of that. And I guess that's what I'd I guess that's how I'd describe my general thing, well, that I do.
as a film critic, I don't even know if this is a fair question to ask, but could you tell us right off the top of your head, best movie you've ever seen, worst movie you've ever seen?
Well, definitely I have bests. So the go-to bests are actually twofold. It's either 2001 by Stanley Kubrick.
Okay, right.
Or every film by Andrei Tarkovsky, who is a Russian director who made 7 features. There's a great story where he, as a young man, went to a medium and he told the medium to call up the spirit of Boris Pasternak, who I believe wrote Dr. Zhivago, if I'm not mistaken. Uh-huh. A famous Russian author. If I'm wrong on what he wrote, if I'm wrong on the Zhivago thing, I apologize. But Boris Pasternak, famous Russian writer. And Boris Pasternak said, "You will make 7 films." And Tarkovsky was like, "Only 7?" And apparently Pasternak said, "But they'll all be good." And Tarkovsky is just like, maybe because it came at a formative time. I mean, you know, it was just so wonderful to experience all those films, and Kubrick too. I guess I'd now have to add the third thing, obviously, the first X-Files movie, because...
Well, that, of course.
And maybe we can get into my experience of seeing that on opening day during the call, but I won't spoil that quite yet.
Oh, we're definitely going to want to hear that. We love those stories.
Yeah, but so that's best. Now, worst, boy, you know, I think maybe it's just I've gotten to a place where really bad things, I just, you know... I let it slake off and I try not to carry it.
They leave your brain. Like,
And my body and soul, because why do you want to keep that stuff around? I mean, maybe that's because I'm getting more into meditation, and I like I like certain of the Buddhist principles of how one lives life and such. And, you know, I think we might talk on this call a bit about, you know, my shunning of social media lately and everything.
Yeah.
And,
I'm definitely going to ask you about that.
and so maybe that just then leads into, I don't want to carry the bad stuff with me too much. Certainly in the moment when I see something that's really awful, it's like, ugh. But, you know, I found that I've been better able to let them go. And I think it's just better to leave them there.
That's actually a really healthy attitude. I try to do the same. And I think that's actually a really good answer. So
that's very sensible.
But believe me, it's difficult. And I think what's good, though, it can be humbling to just remember we're all human. Mm-hmm. We all have these things. We take this stuff with us nonetheless. But I do believe, you know, we can work with how we react to stuff and everything. And maybe that's just where, you know, the bad stuff. I want to remember the really good stuff, the good stuff that like resonates, you know, not the good stuff that maybe you find pleasure in the moment, but it doesn't really stick with you. I love seeing the stuff that sticks, you know, and so that's why I think I said 2001 and Tarkovsky and the X-Files movie, because, and the series is like, I actually do say that the X-Files in toto is my favorite work of art.
That is okay. Well, I want to hear about your journey with the X-Files. I mean, obviously, we know from your interview with David and Jillian that we'll definitely get to that you are quite the expert. I am myself am very, very impressed at all of the things that you were able to recall and say so succinctly and clearly. Yeah. And it all made perfect sense to me. But I would love to hear how you started on the X-Files and how you got into it.
Yes. So I have to thank a girl named Jenny On, who I don't know if she's out there anywhere, but she was a high school friend of mine. I believe she was maybe freshman or sophomore when I was a senior. As a senior, I was the arts and entertainment editor of my high school newspaper. Mm-hmm. Jenny wrote an article on the X-Files for me. And so that's how I kind of first heard about it. This was when I think it was in season two. So I hadn't watched anything to start with. I didn't start with season one or anything like that. She was writing about it, I think, just before Anasazi aired. Mm-hmm. It was like a few weeks before. I'm going back into my mind now, and this might be Print the Legend, but we'll print the legend. And I think I recall that when she wrote it, Effemasculato was just about to air.
It was kind of near the end, I think, of season two, right?
Yeah, that is near the end. That is near the end of season two. So it was like in the spring or something like that and whatever. And so I was like, oh, this is a really interesting article. And, you know, Jenny was just obsessed with it. And I was like, mm-hmm. All right, well, let me check it out. And so I remember watching Anasazi when first there. And I thought, okay, this is really cool. And then that was my senior year of high school. And I was like, yeah, what happens next? You know, because the Mulder in the boxcar, the flames, mm-hmm. and like, you know, flames on the side of my face, you know, all this stuff. And I was like, okay, this is cool. I wasn't obsessed really. And so then I went to college the next year, NYU, freshman year in 1995. And so third season started, and there were weekly X-Files watches in the lounge downstairs. And so we watched Blessing Way and Paperclip and everything and DPO. Interestingly, I always missed, aside from War of the Coprophages, the Darren Morgan episodes in first run. So I didn't see Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose when it aired. I think maybe I just had work or something. I did see War of the Coprophages. I remember being like really thinking that was really funny, but I missed Jose Chung's, which is my pick for best episode of the series, Jose Chung's from Outer Space.
Oh, because we would have wanted to know that for sure.
Yeah, well, there you go. sorry if I spoiled.
No, no
that,
worries.
But, yeah, I missed Jose Chung's in first run, and so it was basically a third season. I was fairly consistently watching it. Then I remember fourth season. I was making it a point to watch it. This is sophomore year of college. Now, the solidifying thing was Leonard Betts, mm-hmm. because. That was a Super Bowl episode. I think, as everybody knows, it was supposed to be Never Again, but then they switched it around.
Because, don't get me started, Keith.
maybe we'll get into all that and what that means for Scully's character and stuff or whatever, depending. But you know, it was like everybody was going to watch it, so we watched it. I had no idea that the twist was coming of the "I'm sorry, you have something I need." Mm-hmm. Oh my God, she has cancer. And the feeling that went through my body was like this electric, like, I couldn't believe I was fooled to that degree or whatever. Or not even fooled, it's just I didn't anticipate it. I didn't expect it coming. I mean, if I had been maybe a more regular viewer at that point, I might have been like, okay, New Say 731, they see the people who have, you know, the MUFON folk, who I think ultimately have... I think it's in Nissan 731 where one of them has cancer.
Yeah, they lay it out for you. And then it's funny because they weren't even planning it.
And Mulder says, "You're all right, Scully." And she's like, "Am I? I don't know." Yeah. And so that's like planted in third season. And then like, you know, but maybe you'd forget it by fourth season, given how long seasons of television were back in the 90s. But yeah, anyway, it was just this electric charge. And it was just like, okay, I found my metier, and you know, I found the thing that I'm going to watch no matter what. And then the show never fooled me again, except actually it's fooled me twice subsequently, and they were both the same thing: Scully's pregnancies.
See either of those coming, like
because end of season seven, you know, when she's with Skinner in the hospital in, not Biogenesis. Oh,
Requiem.
God, Requiem. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Requiem. And, you know, and I'm having a hard time, believing it, but I'm pregnant. And just before she said I'm pregnant, it was like the entire season played out in my head. And I think I think maybe there was a second where just before she said, like, I'm preg, and I finished it like, nent. You know, before she said nent, and I was like, wah! You know? And then in what is now, I suppose, the series finale, you know, and maybe some people might say it's because of sloppy writing, but you know, I mean, I have different thoughts on that, I guess, but I did not expect her to say to, you know, Mulder, you are a father. And I was like,
that was,
you know, and then, but then I was like, plus one, which is the other Carter penned episode from that season, suddenly took on an entirely other meaning as to, you know, both the name of the motel, which is
right.
Oh God, now I've forgotten.
St. Rachel's.
Rachel's is birth to Joseph in the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat Joseph, and I think, and she died in childbirth on her second child. And, you know, the thing of, and so here's Scully's second child, so to speak. And it's kind of like, you know, the whole thing with throughout the series of her being this kind of Virgin Mary figure and all that, you know, is fascinating to me. But those were the only other two times. See, I'm digressing. Those are the only other two times that the series fooled me. All the other times it was like I was reading, you know, faux plot synopses, and I was just trying to figure this out, that out, that, and I pretty much got everything.
Yeah.
You know? Does that answer your question? I feel like I should.
Yeah. Try. No.
Good answer.
No, that is, and I. That's interesting that you say that, because I always am one of the people. I think Jen to a degree, but I feel like I'm one of the people that is constantly defending the mythology as not being as complicated as people are always making it out to be, and saying, right, you know, it's really honestly not that insane, and it does make sense. Yes, there are a lot of red herrings, but they're put there purposefully. I don't know if that's kind of your vibe on the show overall and its criticism, but I feel like that. So
yeah, no. I'm gonna mention another, you know, like probably to the audience obscure French filmmaker, but there's this filmmaker Jacques Rivette, whose films are, he makes films that have these really elaborate plots that effectively are overcomplicated and meaningless. But what they do is they kind of invite you into this world where nothing is completely explainable. And if you kind of go in, and so I kind of view the X-Files like that. And I mean, a key thing with the X-Files is that one of its biggest fans was Alain René, who is another famous French filmmaker, made last year in Marion Bad and Hiroshima Mon Amour, very elliptical kind of films and such. And he was a huge fan of Kim Manners. And so there's this kind of affinity between French New Wave and, I guess you could say, Euro art filmmaking and, you know, the pulp, the American pulp that a lot of those filmmakers kind of grew up on. And I think what they saw perhaps in the X-Files. And so, you know, I kind of approached the X-Files and its rather torturous narrative convolutions from maybe a Euro art film standpoint to some degree, where I don't need each single point to make sense.
Yeah.
Or even for it to be necessarily coherent, because I think some of it is, you know, when Carter talked, I mean, Carter summed it up as saying it's about the search for God, you know, and it's just like, I think that's the mythology. And really the thing of it is I think the search for God, it's impossible to find God while you are alive, but that doesn't mean you don't keep searching. So that the contradiction of that, you know, is what fascinates me about it, and why I think the show effectively has this endless quality that I know frustrates a lot of people, and I get it. If you're going to it for narrative satisfaction, you're not going to find it.
Right.
Follow Vince Gilligan, because
he's
figured out a way. And I love Vince Gilligan. He figured out a way to do it on, you know, X-Files is a great tutelage for what he did with Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. I would also point to like David Simon on The Wire, you know, as far as like a show that really every narrative beat is concrete and counts in a way. But I think there's something to be said for, you know, a show that doesn't do that. As long as the narrative, whatever the narrative is, kind of fits in with the larger theme.
Right.
And so I think the contradictory nature of the mythology and, you know, the fact that it kind of resets itself. And, you know, then there's a point, you know, at which, you know, like, oh, yeah, those aliens, they're not coming anymore because we fucked up the planet.
Right.
Which I honestly think is one of the funniest narrative.
I love that. People were so pissed about that. And I'm like, that's brilliant. What are you talking about? It was so good.
Made perfect
good.
Sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, it was a great way to sort of take what was currently going on in the world and apply it to this show and sort of, make a joke. It's funny. But it's also a way for them to sort of reset what they were trying to do.
Right. And I mean, then it becomes, as it always does, more about the human machinations more than the alien. And so, you know, I just I am able to kind of like reconcile it within the fiction of the show, because I just feel like, all right, you know, once in the movie they release the giant alien ship from Antarctica, I think that just starts fucking a lot of things up.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then Two Fathers, One Son kind of fucks up the colonization arc. And then I think it's just like, all right, so the aliens are involved for a little bit, and then probably they're like doing some readings on their ship, like, you know, towards the end of season 8 or whatever, season 7. They're like, you know what? The planet's really fucked up, and I don't think it's good to colonize it anymore. So let's get the fuck out of here. And then like Smoking Man is just like, well, I'm just going to use this to manipulate Mulder to my own ends.
Exactly. You
know, which is like demonic to me. And that's what I love about it. You know, a lot of it is silly. A lot of it is silly, but
it's a silly sci-fi show at the end of the day.
But the profundity of it comes from, I think, the fact that it embraces its pulpiness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, you know, a lot of people talk like peak TV now, and I think that's sort of like they're kind of giving it a high quality tone that X-Files never reached for, even when it returned.
Yeah.
You know, even when it returned, Carter was like, no, I'm just going to do what I always did, which is basically tell, it is a continuing story, but it's like these discrete units.
Yeah.
It's kind of mosaic stuff.
They do feel like discrete blocks of time. But yet they all still feel in universe. It's interesting what you were saying earlier about the idea of storytelling, and like, you know, you take a lot of that from, you know, your European influence, and maybe that makes it a little easier for you to swallow. But like, I like the idea that it's not, I mean, you said it's about the search for God. I would argue that, yeah, but about the search for truth, obviously, which is sort of the same thing. And the point of this is that there really isn't, at the end of the day, a truth. There's always going to be another answer, which is when we were speaking to Frank Spotnitz, is something he said, that if you're looking for an answer, you're not going to find it, like you said. And so for the people who are looking for that, they're going to be consistently disappointed, because the purpose is to keep us thinking about it, and to keep us wondering, and to keep us talking about it. And I mean, I can't think of any other show that I still talk about, I mean, Revival or not, like that I still think about and still talk about the possibilities of what this meant and how this worked and what way did this happen. Yeah. And we wouldn't be doing that if the show had operated like a typical show. So
yeah,
I appreciate that.
Or didn't follow its own personal muse. And I mean, the big thing that I say is that The X-Files, I think we have to remember, was a rare series in the 90s where the creator stayed with it the entire way through. You know, even Whedon left Buffy, you know, for this, I think it was the 7th season until the finale, right? You know, so it was like, it was only like, I think like David Chase and The Sopranos that you really start getting the myth of the showrunner, you know, who's there the entire time and is the guiding hand behind it.
Right.
And Carter was an anomaly in that way.
He was like the American first.
You know, and I mean, I know there's the thing in season 9, I think, where he was working out some contractual options, and there were a few episodes written not under his tutelage at the beginning. But I think he even still, once he did get in, went back and like he co-wrote the two mythology episodes to begin. I think he reworked some of the stuff in the early going still. So, I mean, his guiding hand is there. But what I love about it is that he brought all these other people who had these distinct voices into this fold and allowed them to play with this formula in ways that I think they're defined in ways that they're not on other series.
Yeah.
Example, I'll take a late episode writer, Steve Maeda, who wrote some of my favorite season 8 and 9s. I think 4D is one in season 9. I think he did Red Room, if I'm not mistaken. Mm. He kind of did the wibbly wobbly timey wimey, to use, you know, Doctor Who episodes. And I really loved his episodes. They really had a distinct authorial mark. And then he went on to run like the first 5 seasons of CSI Miami, and you couldn't tell from like, you know, any personality. And I just think that's fascinating. You know, like, I think pretty much every writer who went through that show had some kind of distinct personality. And I think the same thing applies to the directors, you know, Rob Bowman, Kim Manners, David Nutter, Kim Manners especially. I mean, And Rob Bowman, especially, I should say, because they're the two main ones. And then cinematographers. The cinematographers, like John Bartley, and you know, season four had like three separate DPs, and you get like Bill Rowe and Joel Ransom and everything. And even to the most recent season, Craig Wrubleski, you know, what he did on Followers, you know, which I can't say the number title, you know, or whatever.
You just say RM9.
Yeah. RM9. I mean, that's just one of the most, you know, stunningly visual things I've seen, you know, on TV in a long time. And it's one of my favorite shots in the series, which is, it's kind of a Spielberg shot, I find. Just Mulder goes out the door and you see his body go out the door and the camera dollies in on a bat. And then he opens the door again and he takes the bat. It's just this a push in. And it just how the narrative information it conveys is so, you know, wonderful and poetic and visual and just dynamic. And it's just like, you don't get that, you know, to the degree that you did consistently on X-Files, I find. So
yeah,
you can see I have a lot of thoughts.
No, oh God, this is like our sweet spot. Don't even worry about it. We love it.
We're happy.
Yeah. Cause Jen, we've told a million guests this before, but I started watching in season 8. So I was a much later viewer. And then Jen, you were in the first season. So.
Yeah, I started watching about halfway through the first season. And I still, to this day, kick myself for not having watched it from the pilot, but at least I got on during the first. Back in the day, that was joining it late at that point. Now, sort of looking back on it, it seems pretty early. But
so, would your first episode be On the Sea by chance?
Middle
of the season.
Yeah. I don't quite remember exactly which one was my first. I just, because I wasn't like you were saying, there's a point at which you start sort of watching it as a casual viewer, but then there's a point at which suddenly it clicks.
And that was
like,
Tombs
and it turns
for
into
you,
a
right?
thing. And that, yeah, that was Tombs for me.
It was that's Tombs, what, okay.
That's the one that stands out in my memory as the one where I was like, oh, that's what turned me into a fan. Up until then, I'd just been kind of a casual viewer, so I don't really remember much about it. But yeah, I remember Tombs quite clearly as that kind of light bulb moment when I became a fanatic, and I have been ever since.
Yeah, great. Fantastic.
Yeah. Let's talk about your Paley Center interview with David and Jillian. So this must have been like a dream gig for you, right? How did you get this gig and how did this all come about?
Yeah. Okay. see, it was so pleasurable to do. And okay, let me just start from the beginning. So I live in New York. I know the Paley Center. I've been to things there and or I've watched stuff. Yeah. And I saw that this panel was coming up. There was no moderator listed, but I was just like, oh, that's interesting. And I saw, you know, I saw it announced, and then I think it like sold out like that or whatever, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, but I usually don't buy things to go to that. I just like, oh, I'll watch it later. And I was just thinking I'd do that or whatever. I have my friend Matt Zoller-Seitz, who maybe people might have heard of. He's a fellow critic and writer of such books as the Wes Anderson Collection and a book on Mad Men, a book of recaps. He's currently working on a Deadwood book that he self-funded, and I might be contributing to. I think he wants there to be a section on David Milch's show, John from Cincinnati, which I really love. And so I might write about that. But anyway, Matt knew David Buschman, who is the head guy at the Paley Center. And I think, as David had told me, and David Buschman actually just wrote recently a really amazing interview book with Mark Frost for any Twin Peaks fans out there. Very fascinating book. But anyway, Buschman is basically like the Paley Center guy who sets up all these things. I think his original thing was that he wanted Vince Gilligan to host the panel, maybe. Don't entirely quote me on that, but that's kind of what I remember. And then I don't think Vince Gilligan could do it. And I think he asked Matt, and then Matt said, you got to get Keith. You know this guy, Keith Ulick. And so that's how I believe it happened. I was not privy to all of this, so if I'm mistaking any of this, maybe they're going to hear this and they can correct me. But where I come in is I'm sitting in the timeout offices. I open my email. It's a letter from David Buschman saying, hi, Keith, Matt Zoller-Seitz recommended you to me. We would love it if you could host the Paley Center panel
I can see the look on your face. You're just like, no. What? What?
Yeah. No, and I'm like reading it now. could you let me know soon? So I wrote him back, and I was like, David, 99.9% yes. I just need 20 minutes because I am hosting a party at my house on Saturday. And I just need to make sure that my husband, Dan Callahan, another great film writer, just plugging my husband.
we welcome plugs.
Yes. I just have to make sure that Dan can host for a few hours while I leave and co-host this. I'm sure he'll say yes.
And I hope Dan understood. I hope he did.
So I called Dan and I was like, hey, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, David, Julia, you know, and
relatable.
Just talking in like, you know, half words like that. And then when I finally got out complete sentences, he was just like, Keithy, of course you have to do this. Yes, I'll co-host the I was able to be there for when people started arriving at the party. It's just I was gonna have to like exit for like, you know, 4 or 5 hours so I could go to Manhattan early Saturday. To interview David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson. And so he said yes. And even before the 20 minutes had elapsed, I like wrote back, or I might have called back to David Bushman. So I was like, David, yes, 100%. I'm there. Come hell or high water, I'm there. And this is 2 days before.
Yeah.
2 days.
Wow. They didn't have a moderator 2 days before. That's crazy.
I'm recalling it being 2 days before. Mm-hmm. So then it's into Yeah, then it gets into semi-panic mode because bring it around to the fandom thing. You know, I know how fans can be. Mm-hmm. I've seen how fans treat moderators.
Yeah.
And, oh, yeah.
Well, and I know how moderators can make it all about themselves as opposed to the subjects, or they don't know the subject and they just keep asking questions and they talk over people and stuff. And so I just said to myself, okay, remember, this is about them and you are there to help them feel comfortable and to allow whatever transpires. Have maybe a page of written questions. You know, I had a page of like certain things of like, you know, I wanted to talk about the motel room scene in the pilot. I wanted to ask about their directorial efforts. I wanted to ask about, you know, I remember one question was, do you remember where you were when the show premiered? Like, you know, the first episode, like, and I think they were like shooting like Lazarus or, you know, or Young at Heart or something like that, you know, right. Maybe, or I think it was Harsh Realm guy, Scott Bairstow, Miracle Man. Yes.
That's it. Okay.
I think it was something like that. But, you know, I was curious about things like that. So I just noted those down and I said, and remember, Keith, you just don't want to be beholden to these questions. If you sense something in the moment, mm-hmm. you know, that either you can follow up later, you know, which I had a pen. So I was writing down certain things when I was interviewing them just in case, just prompts to remind myself, you know, but it was always just about when they're talking to each other, let them talk to each other.
Yes.
Because what we love about this is this thing they got.
Yep. Yep.
And I am there to just try to help eke that out in whatever way possible. Now, I will say when I got there, this is a little different, but when I got there, I was still scared shitless.
I'll bet. You know,
and I don't have much memory of the panel beyond flashes, I would say, because I think there was a degree to which I maybe left my body.
Yeah.
But I will always take with me, you know, they take us down. I met them in the green room, first of all. So I went up to the green room by myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting there and I have a picture of me just sitting in the green room by myself, like over my foot, you know, and there's like a spread or whatever. And it's facing the door and I'm just like, you know, just like I'm waiting for people to come through. And then the publicist comes and says, okay, they're here. And like, they walked in and I was just like, all right, here we go.
Oh, God. Like, you know, oh my God.
I just got up and it was like, you know, shaking their hand, just say I'm the moderator, but trying to keep somewhat of a distance mm-hmm. because I also know, don't tread into their personal space too much, you know, let them do whatever. They take us down and they have to mic us up. There's like a basement area where you can go where they mic you up. And then they take you to kind of wait outside where you will then go out onto the stage and stuff. And so I'm waiting there, you know, Jillian and David are standing next to me. It's like, okay.
We want all the details. How were they acting? Were they talking to each other? Were they?
They were just very professional. very professional, but, you know, loose and kind of like, you know, but I mean, I get the sense of like, you know, when you've done so much of this stuff and when you're as identified as they are, I think what often is forgotten, which I actually wish I had brought up on the stage, is that I think it's easy for fans to forget that for them, this is work.
Yeah.
And it's very, very difficult work. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very repetitive work.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's a degree to which I think, oh, well, they must be having so much fun all the time. You belong to me, you know, and like, yeah, you're ours. And it's just like, no, they're people.
Yeah.
And you got to kind of just give them their space and stuff. And, you know, where you can entree, you can entree. But so I'm standing there, though, with, you know, the mic, we're waiting to go on. And just I'm like standing like at attention, like I'm a soldier going off to battle or something like that. And Jillian looks at me, kind of looks at me up and down. Is like, are you a dancer? And I just turned to her and I was like, oh, no, this is just my don't fuck this up pose. I think I either said that or I think I said that. It might have also been, this is just my scared shitless pose. To whichever one she just sort of, she was like, oh, she laughed. So yeah, I was like, I mean, oh my God. You know, and
then
a nice bookend to that. We can talk any specifics about the panel that you want in a moment, but I just want to say that after the panel was over and we went back upstairs, she turned to me, Jillian, and she said, I want to give you a hug. That was really wonderful, you know, the panel, and she hugged me.
Oh my God. Everyone is squeeing right now.
And
you deserve that hug, though. You really did.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, on behalf of all of the fandom, I mean, whether they want to admit it or not, you deserved that completely.
No, I mean, and look, you know, there's a part of me that wants to be egocentric and say, yes, I do. God knows, you know, and I am the number one X-Files fan. But, you know, the other thing of it is, I got to remain humble about it too, because it is humbling to be up there and then to do it as well as you hoped you would do it. And then find that pretty much everyone agrees and how lovely that was. And that, you know, I mean, I understand why people would want me to do it again. I haven't been asked to do anything like it again. And there's a part of me that kind of hopes I never am.
Right.
Just because
you can't duplicate that, though. Like,
I can't duplicate it. I'd love to try and do it again I'd love to go into the new seasons, because we got to remember this was before the new seasons came in, and I'd love to ask them some things about that. But, you know, there is just something effectively unrepeatable about it, and I just feel like it could potentially be diminishing returns. I just need to be, I might be far enough away from it that I think I could rethink how I would do it, or just be open to, you know, not repeating myself, because I would, God knows, not want to do that. It was stem to stern, it was just like an amazing experience, and then it was bookended 2 weeks later by me having my appendix explode, and I had to have my appendix. So thank God it did, my appendix was not exploding when I was on stage, because I would have hosted.
You would have done it anyway.
Dick's exploding.
You would have pulled a slash on stage and kept playing through your defibrillator going off, right?
Yeah, I would have cut it out myself, and I would have been like doing this, you know, ripping out my intestines or something, you know. But no, I mean, it's it was stem to stern. It was a wonderful experience. They were very kind, to the degree I think that they can be with someone who is not in their immediate circle. And, you know, I mean, I don't. Yeah. I think there was a point at which then Jillian and David then kind of went back to being, you know, the kind of stoic pros and everything, but as well they should, because I think they do need to protect themselves.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of predatory stuff out there, from, you know, the minor to the major, and, you know, and they have to think about that. And I think that can be forgotten sometimes. Mm-hmm. But you know, it was a really great experience. So. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. But if you have any questions specific. Oh, sorry,
I really like what you said there, Keith, because I've always, because it's probably my favorite David and Jillian interview, and probably a lot of people's. And you know, I was always like, what's the alchemy? Like, how did this happen? But I think you've summed it up with what you said, that because you're a fan, you get it, that it's about them and the interaction between them, not just about giving them a chance to speak, but also about them interacting with each other. So I always really appreciated the way that you just sort of got out of their way and let them speak, which doesn't always happen. So I think that that was, you really got it, and you just understood what people were there for, and you executed it so well.
Thank you. I mean, that was the intention, and it seemed to have gone off well. I've seen a few dissenters here and there, but most people seem to like my green tie that I was wearing and everything, and be all right. So, yeah, I mean, it was, and to be, you know, the fan that I've been, and the obsessive that I've been, and to kind of have that be the culminating thing. Although there will be an X-Files book for me someday. I have an idea of how I want it to be. And I think it'll be a critical study, but probably written in, I'm figuring out structure and other things, but I definitely want to write about the different seasons and also then the contributions of directors, the cinematographers, maybe the editors. I mean, you know, you have all these different interesting editors like Stephen Mark and, oh God, what's her name? I've forgotten her name. Okay. Well, see, there's so much information. Sometimes it even, I can't keep it at immediate recall. But there's so many interesting facets of production to that series that I'd love to delve into. So
That would be really interesting reading, because that's something that isn't written about a whole lot, and that I don't know a lot about, the whole sort of cinematography and the editing. That I think that would be really fascinating.
So we'll see how it goes.
Anyway. We'll be eager to read that when it comes out. We're always looking forward to new X-Files content in whatever form it may take. I wanted to point out, because I wanted to talk about some of the stuff that came up in the interview, because like Jen said, like a lot of the magical moments were just between them. But in particular, I think one of my favorite aspects of the interview, and I think a lot of people would agree, is moments when you clearly know what you're talking about, and both of them are just completely like, I think David knows more than he lets on personally, but Jillian is just like, I have no idea what you're talking about. It was so incredibly hilarious to watch that as a fan, because that is all of us. Like in that moment, you are all of us. And it reminded people that sometimes what they say about the show or what they remember about the show is very different and maybe even somewhat muted in comparison to what we do. I think that's another thing that's important for people to remember when they say things about the show, or if they take certain meanings from things they say. And it's like they had a completely different experience of this series than we did as fans. And I loved that you got to like kind of visually show that in the interview.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm presuming we can term it the "what the fuck is magnetite" quality of the.
That's the
classic.
Yeah, no, I mean that's the only clip of the interview I can really rewatch. I mean, I have trouble watching myself, doing things. I think so, because I think I just look geeky and I have like this weird Joker smile, or whatever. And
we all related though. So,
I mean, that was honestly too, probably that moment was so key too, because that's where I think everything finally connected, where they felt most comfortable, because Jillian is just on laughing gas there. And so I think that just brings her to a certain kind of like level, and then David is like, oh, he's flying into the rock, and it's just like, and she's looking at him like for guidance almost, and then she's looking at me sometimes, and she can't help laughing when she stares at me.
Time she would, there was a moment too where she would look at you and she just was just like I can't, like it's too funny. Everything that's happening right now is just too crazy. I just, it was so great.
Yeah, and I think though, but very human too, and hopefully did in the subtext, I would hope to some connect that, their experience of it is different, as the writers would be, because if you're, producers would be, as the directors would be, because if you're in the thick of production of something, that's different than when you're watching something that's actually done.
Yeah.
You know, I learned in film school, I don't want to make movies. I thought maybe I did, but no, I like them when they're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, film sets are boring or intense as fuck.
Tedious,
and And you have to guide people.
Right.
And I think, you know, it connected with me. As a critic, who was very formative for me, Philip LaPate, wrote a personal essay where he talked about making a student film and then, you know, didn't turn out as he kind of hoped it would. And then, you know, a critic friend of his in the student paper, like, gave him praise and everything. And, like, hopefully LaPate will keep making films or whatever. And, you know, and then LaPate writes something like, no, that's okay. I'd have my fun. I can control pen and paper better. Yeah. And, you know, that's the thing. Yeah. I think filmmaking, you have to control people in a way that gets really intense. And I mean, I think maybe we saw some of that in how Jillian reacted to some of the things in the later season here, you know, with some of the twists and turns and stuff, which, look, I understand. And I, you know, I sympathize from an act. If I personally am okay with all the story points that Carter came across, because I think they all have a meaning to his kind of, you know, new Catholicism or old Catholicism sometimes that he, you know, shapes the series through, or Christianity, you know, I understand why it might rub Jillian the wrong way, especially at a time when, you know, we're trying to get more representation for women, people of color, etc. And, you know, I think the show, what's interesting about the show to me thematically is that it does have a kind of retrograde quality to it.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the mythology, which I think stems from the fact that it's kind of stealing from biblical text, you know, biogenesis, the ship. The ship is made up of clips from text from the Bible, text from the Quran, text from that the ship is the Rosetta Stone for the show.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're taking from religious texts, you're going to run up against really
problematic current issues. Yeah.
Retrograde things, frankly, when you try to apply them to a world where a lot more people are rightfully so trying to fight to be heard and recognized and other things.
Yeah.
But, you know, this gets into probably naughtier conversations about how I don't think art needs to mimic life and should actually run counter to it to some degree.
Yeah.
You know, and which does not mean, and let me say now, this does not mean I'm saying that The X-Files is above criticism. I would have plenty of critical things to say about it that would go just beyond, like, you know, Fight Club, worst episode ever, or, you know, Teso Dos Bichos, oh, the Killer Kitties episode. You know, I mean, you know, there are things about it where, you know, it's this weird, here's the paradox. I wouldn't change a thing of how the show is.
Right.
But there's plenty of what it is that I can criticize for being the way it is.
That's absolutely 100% how I feel, completely.
Yeah.
It's at the end of the day, it's a work, it's a piece of art, and it's someone else's art, and it's up to us to interpret it the way that we would like to interpret it. But we, at the end of the day, don't have control, and shouldn't.
No.
So.
No. No. And you know, so yeah, I mean, that's. I don't know if I had a larger point than basically that. I mean, it's a fairly large point, but yeah, it's just like, There's a lot in the show that, you know, rubs up against how I think some people who were involved in it react to it. I understand why Jillian reacted the way she did. I understand why David reacted the way that he did when he wanted to leave after season 7. He'd been doing this thing for 7 years.
Yeah.
You know, and then he came back for some of season 8. I understood why he left in season 9.
Yeah.
And yeah, I know when season 9 happened and, like, you know, was it Doggett comes to the door and then, like, she opens it and she's like, where's Mulder? And he's like, he's gone. And I just quipped, his contract ran out. You know what
I mean? Yeah.
I mean, of course I did that. But at the same time, he's like, what can you do?
Right.
This is the hand that they'd been dealt.
Yep.
Jillian was set for 9 seasons according to the contract, and Fox wasn't letting go.
And here's the thing. I think a lot of people, too, make the mistake, and I think in a lot of areas, that they take a tiny piece of information that they have and then assume they know everything. And there's so much more behind the scenes. There's so much more to all of these stories. It can't be reduced to just, oh, well, you know, Chris Carter's terrible. He should have stopped the show. And I'm just like, it's not his decision. If he would have wanted to leave, he could have left. And then the X-Files would have been taken over by someone else with Jillian. And it would have been very, very different. It wouldn't have been the same show. And it would have probably been much worse, I think, personally.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I would agree only because I think the show is so unique to Carter's own makeup. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just whatever you think of him. It's just like something stems so personally from him into that show. I am still fascinated that there were so many other authorial personalities, you know, Darren right. Morgan, Vince Gilligan, Steve Maeda.
Also different.
You
know,
even people who were, I think, are more like criticized, like Jeffrey Bell or John Scheiben, you know, they have a mark. Mm-hmm. They have a personal stamp there. I mean, you know, like John Scheiben finally won me over with Bodla in season 8. You know, which I just think is one of the craziest things I've ever seen.
There are things about Badla that are great.
He often took like the race episodes, you know, or the weird racial episodes. I think did he write Teleco? I think he might have.
Ooh, I don't know that off the top of my hand. I can look it up while you're talking.
I don't know, but yeah. Well, the big one, El Mundo Gyro.
Oh, yeah.
So, something like that, you know. Oof. Which, yeah, I know. which I can defend on an intellectual level.
Howard Gordon did Teleco.
Howard Gordon wrote Teleco.
Yeah.
So I was wrong on that. But yeah, I mean, actually, you're saying that. I mean, Howard Gordon going on to like Homeland and stuff in 24. I mean, he had a whole, you know, right. thing on the X-Files too. Like Kaddish, I remember, was very personal for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm fascinated that there was this basically controlling puppet master who basically let the puppets he was controlling run the asylum to some degree.
Right.
You know, and that there are all these things. Like, I just rewatched Pusher with some people who were going through the X-Files for the first time. They'd never seen Pusher. And I was just like, yeah, like, this is Vince Gilligan's second episode. And there's so much of who Vince Gilligan is in that piece.
Yeah.
And you can see how, you know, from his affinity for creating like amazing side characters like Frank Burst, or even like the or you know the guy who Pusher talks into immolating himself.
Right.
You know, just that guy just kind of like insinuates himself into your head because it's just so frightening to like see him with like the gas can. And there's something ridiculous about it to some degree. Like, my friend laughed a bit when he saw it, but it was a really like uncomfortable laugh.
Yeah.
You could see what was going to happen. And, you know, I think it's very possible that the Russian roulette scene in Pusher is like one of the greatest set pieces they've ever done.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's also my supposition that the platonic nature of the Mulder-Scully relationship breaks down in the last moment of Pusher when she touches his finger.
I agree. I mean, a lot of people would argue that like Chris Carter was strong-armed into changing this. And I never believed that for a second. I see your face. It's like, for people to think that, I just don't understand, because he's a showrunner. He knows what he has. He knows he has to drag this out as long as humanly possible. And it's funny because I love the idea that like at a certain point he does give into that because it's time.
Yeah.
I think, and even Frank said, he's like, at a certain point we're like, this is just getting ridiculous, we've got to do it. But he was able to do it in a way that sort of kept it mysterious, and it kept it interesting, and it kept us wanting more. And that was such a cool way to do it, I think.
And yeah, and I mean, not to say he planned certain things ahead of time, but I'm still amazed that like season one, the Jersey Devil, the whole discussion about Scully having kids and everything with like, you know, with everything with the friend whose birthday party she goes to,
right.
and the blind date with the real, you know, Cirque du Soleil ticket hawking idiot, you know, is just like so germane to ultimately what happens in, you know, seasons 10 and 11, you know, in terms of where Scully goes with, well, even with season 7, 8,
you know, even throughout,
throughout, you know, and it's just like, I think the minute they see each other in the office in the pilot, it's a love story.
Yeah.
And I think Carter knew it, even if only intuitively, it's a love story. And, you know, I mean, fine, non-shippers, you exist, I acknowledge you.
Yes.
But I just feel like it's like, you know, it's so palpable that's there. And it just like, but it's going to take time for them to get there.
Right.
And, you know, and several almost to fake out kisses. You know,
but they're so delicious. Like, it's
I recently rewatched this last scene of Millennium, and yeah, the New Year's kiss is so lovely.
It's so perfect. I mean, and I think it's amazing because you have these two completely different scenarios, and I'm going to want to hear your Fight the Future story in a moment. But to circle back, how this started was we were talking about how their experience of the show is very different than ours. I feel like that's where we kind of digressed and did our all parentheses, quote unquote. But yeah, but I mean, the Millennium Kiss too is it's not the same as the Fight the Future. Like, I feel like both of those kisses went different directions by the very nature of how they happened.
It's not the Fight the Future kiss. It's not the triangle kiss.
No.
It's not the Millennium kiss. It's not the existence kiss.
Yeah.
It's not the truth kiss.
They're all different.
It's not the I want to believe kiss, mm-hmm. which, you know, I feel like this is my, if it ended with I want to believe, I feel like I want to believe is the New Testament to seasons 10 and 11's Old Testament. You know, I feel like especially the, because I think, you know, the ending of I want to believe, you have Scully in the hospital. It ends with Scully, mm-hmm. and, you know, and the three nuns coming up, which Carter says in the commentary are the three graces.
Yeah.
You know, and the way she smiles at the kid at the end is just one of the most beautiful, like, illuminating.
Yeah.
Something Jillian does, and the way the camera moves, it's like she's human, and then she's a goddess. She's the virgin.
And I mean, the blue imagery. Yeah, he loves that stuff.
I mean, he's drawing on stuff like that. You can see it in Christmas Carol and Emily, how Emily ends, you know, stuff like that. And then, like, you know, I say 10 and 11 are Old Testament because I think what the mice struggles ultimately build to in part four is this just complete, like, biblical raising of everything.
Yeah.
You know, the any remnants of the conspiracy, you know, Barbara Hershey gets Fury blown up. I say the Fury. If you've seen the Fury, John Cassavetes gets telekinetically blown up at the end. So when Hershey gets telekinetically blown up at the end of that, I think of the Fury by Brian De Palma. and like Mulder is just, you know, shoots all these people dead. The weird fucked up thing at the end of, like, the smoking man thinking he's killing Mulder, but he's actually killing William, who's in the guise of his spiritual father, not biological father. That's the whole thing in the series, because Bill Mulder is not Mulder's biological father. Mm-hmm. The smoking man is.
Well,
I mean, I believe that's the case.
I agree with you. I think there's enough evidence to support that. Yeah. So, yeah.
And you know, and so I think one of the large themes of the series is the spiritual versus the biological, mm-hmm. you know, and how someone can be more of a father to you who is a spiritual father than the biological father who is less than a dog to you, which is what, you know, and so the whole fucked up nature of the paternity stuff, which, yes, I see the retrograde criticism there, but in terms of what the series is narratively and doing, I think makes perfect sense and is portrayed not as a good thing. It's evil.
It's not supposed to be a good thing. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's just like, you know, so I'm sorry. You see, I'm getting.
No, I like talking about this stuff. I would love to hear it.
It's all interesting.
Yeah.
This is all kind of maybe for the book too, but it's just like, again, though, I would say, the way I would defend the show in its entirety is on the level of theme. Mm-hmm. I think how it's enacted from a narrative standpoint is often very sloppy.
Yeah.
Well, there's a part of me that says I don't care. I mean, I do care only to the sense that as a critic, I would feel that I would have to point it out and say, look, sometimes it's the flaws in the diamond that makes it the diamond.
Yeah, it's still the diamond. It's just, you know, it's got its own little character. Yeah.
Again, I would just say, you want perfect point by point stuff, Breaking Bad is a great place to go.
Yep.
I would also say, though, that a lot of what Vince Gilligan did in Breaking Bad and now Better Call Saul has become the new norm, where everybody is just like, every single point is plotted out, mm-hmm. and you feel it, and it is dead on screen.
Yeah.
You know, it's dead. You know, I'm not talking the Vince Gilligan stuff. I'm just saying
the stuff trying to emulate it. Yeah.
TV stuff where it's just like, see, every single narrative point has its answer, mm-hmm. but It's boring.
Yeah. It's not as interesting, you know, because, yeah, you don't get to mull it over. It's just spoon-fed to you. And
which is not to say that a plotted-out show cannot be great, because Breaking Bad, I think, is a terrific show. I've watched it several times. I think it's a magnificent work of art.
It is perfect. It's perfect.
But it stems from a personal place, and that's what gives it. These other things don't. It's more like, you know, I don't like using the word content personally, because I think it gives something like a kind of mechanized feel, like we're just putting it together on an assembly line. You know, art is not content to me. It's right. Real true art, there's something unquantifiable about it, and we just kind of have to remember that. And there's something unquantifiable about X-Files. Actually, its contrivance is that it was always trying to be unquantifiable in so many ways, while also kind of promising you that there was something out there, and then kind of showing you, actually, you can't, even if you get to know this answer,
you're going to want gonna another
be all
one.
These other things. Yep. There's going to be all these other things that you're going to have to keep going. And maybe, I love the penultimate shot of My Struggle 4, because it's just like, you know, Mulder and Scully hugging on the dock.
Yeah.
That with that light, it's
beautiful.
It's a very soundstage kind of image, you know, and regardless of whatever the dialogue and the torturous kind of way you get to that moment,
right.
you still get to that moment. And then what I love about the last shot being William kind of resurrected is that it feels like it's kind of a torch passing onto whatever's next.
Right.
You know, the last person you see in the series is William, and it's kind of like, and now here comes the youth.
Right.
You know, the new thing that we don't know what. You know, because it's so weird. He's killed when he's Mulder, and then he becomes.
Right.
You see, this is what's so fascinating about this, because even if you feel like it's narratively sloppy getting to there, it resonates on the level of theme, and it's so fascinating to me. I mean, it resonates for me. Let me just say, I recognize it doesn't resonate for everyone.
Yeah.
It doesn't resonate for a lot of people. God knows, I know.
Trust me, we all know. I'm kind of with you. I mean, I can sense and understand why people didn't care for it. But I agree with you that in a way, as much as the X-Files can be, it's narratively sound. It's coherent with the rest of the series. I think that the idea that, you know, William/Jackson is the ultimate X-File is a really interesting way to take his character. And I really always liked that. I have my issues with My Struggle 4, as I think many people do, but we all do. But I mean, at the end of the day, it is what it is. And I feel like you can interpret, I have found interpretation of My Struggle 4 that I have made my peace with it. And if this is where we leave them, I'm content. I'm fine with that.
I was fine with it when it was the truth. I was fine with it when it was I Want to Believe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was fine with it when it was Requiem and we didn't know what the fuck.
Jen would agree with you on that.
Yeah.
That's my favorite ending.
Yeah. And, you know, I am fine with, well, and I was fine with it actually with My Struggle too, if it was just going to be Scully on the bridge, because I think the dolly into her eye, you know, with the light above, I mean, you know, you're looking into a light. Is it going to destroy you or is it going to give you enlightenment? You don't know. And that just seems to me to be like, again, every cliffhanger that he has done, I feel like speaks to something thematic. I'm thinking Scully on the beach with the ship at the end of Biogenesis, the files burning in the end.
Yeah.
You know, any of that stuff. It's just like, he knows Carter is great on theme. As far as beat by beat narrative storytelling, some things hit better than others.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you're kind of seeing a preview of how I feel like I'm going to have to approach a critical study, because I think there has to be some criticism of that, but not to the point of saying any of this should be changed.
Yeah.
Because what I believe with criticism is you get what you get and you have to deal with what you get. And if your thing is that you're saying, well, if they only did this, then this. Mm-hmm. You don't know that. There's no way we can know that.
That's kind of worthless. Yeah. It's just, because it isn't. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Like, you don't know how things would have turned out. You don't know how. Yeah.
And please, let me say, you hate it? Hate it.
Yeah.
It's fine. Mm-hmm. You love it? Great. You know, I think what you say about making your peace with it is a good thing, because maybe what I would just say for the fandom is I hope that everybody can come to appreciate the series in toto, you know, in all its ups, downs, and in-betweens. That's what I'd love to see.
Yeah, I would. Oh,
even yes. Acknowledging that there are ups, downs, and in-betweens, you know, and I understand if you jumped off. I mean, I've jumped off of plenty of series and you just didn't come back, but you know, this is one that really benefits a full watch.
Yeah.
And I think for me, a full engagement and constant re-engagement, mm-hmm. though I recognize it's a big ask. It's 217 episodes and 2 movies. I get it.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody's going to be able to do that. I can only say that I think, it really is one of the great works of art in my lifetime. I'm so glad I got to experience it in its moment, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Nice. I really liked what you say, Keith, about narrative versus theme, because I think you're right that today, especially people who are watching it sort of in today's kind of milieu, that there is such an emphasis on narrative now, and yeah. that it's perceived as like an insurmountable flaw if the narrative is weak in places, mm-hmm. and less of a sort of interpretation and respect for theme,
yeah.
and that it's nearly impossible to get both of those right. And yeah, I think that emphasizing theme is a choice. And, yeah. you know, if it's occasionally at the expense of the narrative, that's okay. But I think that in today's kind of cultural interpretation of television, maybe that people don't think that's okay, because that is such an emphasis now.
Yeah, I mean, generally, yeah, it's, you know, it can be easy to, and this might segue into a social media discussion.
Let's do it.
It's easy to. When I left Facebook, I did tell people I was leaving. I mean, hopefully not too dramatically or anything. I tried not to be, but, you know, I basically said that, you know, social media isn't the world, but it sure makes you think it is.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And so I think we have to remember, it's not that social media can't affect the world, because mm-hmm. God knows it has. But it is not by itself the world, and I would say is not even representative of the majority of the world.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are not on it. You know, a lot of people, though, use it as a megaphone to make you think that it is the entire world.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we're talking about kind of engaging online fandom, or engaging with the X-Files fandom online, I mean, look, I was doing it back when we're talking message boards and personal GeoCities websites where people were writing long critiques of each episode. I did want to tell you one particular story from this. I remember I was like, I have to remember to tell them this. There was a point in season 8 where I was on a message board. You know, everybody was tearing into season 8. I think I remember listening to an episode where you guys were talking about very much that, about how season 8 was like ripped apart, like moment by moment, week by week when it was airing. You know, it was just, I mean, it was demoralizing.
Yeah.
It was demoralizing to look at it. And it wasn't, this is the thing, I can't really even remember any real good opinions, because there was no real opinion that seemed to be given out of a genuine love of, if not for the show, then at least for the writing.
Yeah.
You know, at the very least, I mean, the reason I'm a critic, I love criticism. I love the idea of engaging with a work of art and, you know, stealing a line from the Michael Mann Miami Vice, illuminating it from the inside. I love that line.
You know,
that's
beautiful.
Yeah. And I mean, they're talking in Miami Vice about illuminating a drug operator's operations. But, you know, I mean, I like the idea, because one of my favorite critics is Manny Farber, and he always talked about burrowing inside a movie. And so I have this kind of dual thing of like, you burrow inside the movie and then you kind of like illuminate it from the inside. And I think what I kind of like about that idea is that you're kind of entering an organism, but you're not killing it. Mm-hmm. And maybe I think what I'm seeing is that, you know, a lot of people were trying to kill the X-Files on those message boards.
Oh, God,
like,
yes.
Really just kill it. But the thing that was so funny and that I think kind of pushed me away from really, I really just made me say, all right, I just got to put up, not a mental block. I mean, I might engage with some of this, but I have to like protect myself ultimately, because it's so absurd.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who got on and said, this show hasn't been good since season 1.
Oh my God. Oh, what?
And he went on, as he went on writing, I realized he had watched every single episode subsequently from season one, and it was season eight when he was saying this.
Oh my God.
Now, can you think of anything more absurd than something you are not enjoying it? You have not liked this thing for 7 years. You know, and unless this is like an embryonic version of a Russian troll, which I guess it could
be. It was probably.
It was just like the absurdity of thinking that you would stick with something that you don't have to like it.
This is exactly what I would love to understand, which is this sort of ugly dark side of a fandom that it seems just like constant. And I don't even want to say criticism, because some of it is just so emotionally driven that it is just anger. It is relentless. And I am just constantly like, how are you still so angry about this? Why is this a show that you watch? Why is this something that you even considered enjoying at some point if all you want to do is tear it down? I feel like this happens quite frequently. And it is disheartening. It's demoralizing, because I'm like, I love this show and I want to talk about the things that I love about it. Like you say, it's not above criticism. It certainly isn't. But there's a difference between being critical and just dragging something down like forever.
Yeah. You know, and this is the thing, like, yeah, it's not just the internet, because it's not the internet. There's a lot of good things that have come out of us being able to be connected in the way like this. Like, you know, we're connecting this way with this pandemic too. Look, Zoom, Skype, they've been godsends for me to be able to keep touch with people.
Right.
Yeah. And like, you know, I've kept touch with people and on a regular basis, you know, that I have not in life. And I think there are some lessons that I could perhaps take from this into whenever the pandemic does end, you know, to in terms of how to interact in life and also how to be online as well.
Right.
Yeah, because I think there are good ways of doing it. But yeah, it's just, you know, the demoralizing quality of like reading some of this anger and stuff. I mean, you know what it is? It's an addiction. Mm-hmm. It's addicted. And I'm not, let me say, I'm not immune to it. I did very early on, even when I was posting under like a, you know, a pseudonym or a screen name, I always signed my posts Keith, because I said, you know what, I need to acknowledge that I wrote this. Mm-hmm. I think that's honestly the first step in being here online. Mm-hmm. Acknowledge who you are for real.
Yeah.
The words that you type. Acknowledge that you wrote this. Stand by the fact that you did. There is a real druggy hit to being anonymous.
Yes, absolutely.
Just kind of, you know, to respond to shout into the void, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't think the entire internet is the void. I don't think the entire fandom is the void. And I'm a little worried that in talking like this, that any fans who are listening might think that I'm, you know, trying to disparage all fandom. No, like the internet too, there are really good qualities to it in terms of like a lot of the reason the X-Files stuck around is because of the fandom that it generated and, you know, and the love that people showed it. But there's a dark side to it too. And I honestly just feel if the dark side doesn't necessarily win, it does shout itself a bit louder than the love a lot of times. And, you know, that's, well, you know, and then that's the thing. You have to acknowledge to some degree, to a large degree, you don't have any control over it. And you really have to take steps to protect yourself from it and make sure you don't do it.
Yes.
Because any of us can do it. Mm-hmm. And have I done it? Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And have I done it? I mean, I don't know if some of any of my old X-Files posts, whatever I posted, you know, I think there are times where maybe tone-wise, I would really regret some of the ways I talked.
Yeah, oh, we all have. Absolutely. It happens. You know,
and, you know, it's just, I mean, maybe I'll throw it back to you. I'm not quite sure where we could go from here with this.
Yeah. No. I mean, I didn't want to like bring the thing down, but I get where you're coming from when you just kind of talk about the disheartening nature of it at times. Especially when it's kind of just the same stuff over and over and over and over again. And I'm just, it gets exhausting. Like it really does. And I just sometimes need to step away and be like, I need, sure. to, like you said, you need to sort of realize that like what you're participating in when you participate in any sort of fandom is just a tiny microcosm of the actual group of people and the actual set of opinions that are out there.
Yeah.
And like you said, sometimes the ones you don't want to hear are the loudest. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would also say that it would be good if we could remember, and this is maybe also a general thing on social media, that anything we post has the potential to make someone have a very bad day.
Yes.
Because I can't tell you the number of times, you know, randomly scrolling past something, I see something that someone has expressed in a really, with a really negative bent. And I'm not just talking about an opinion about the X-Files. I'm just talking like a negatively tinged post. Mm-hmm. Anything from like the world sucks to the X-Files sucks, you know, and however deep they go into it. Mm-hmm. And you can say something is bad without saying that basically the world is worthless and we might as well lie down. Well, just all lie down and die.
Right.
Because, I there is a way of criticizing something without bringing the room down. Mm-hmm. And so much of the tenor of the discourse is bringing the room down. And have I brought the room down with some of the tenor of my discourse? I am willing to bet absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because I think we have to remember, you know, we're speaking into a public space where anybody can see it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has the potential to really, I'm not saying we should just like be all, you know, dog pictures and roses or something either. I feel like there's ways of using this technology to really, you know, connect. And I just think at a certain point, you know, it's very easy for the discourse around the X-Files, the world, whatever subject you want to say, to tip over into just shouting into the void. And there was so much of that, even as far back as, you know, 95, 96, 97 on the posting boards. You know,
right, back like, in the day.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. No, I find all of this incredibly interesting, especially like talking about one medium while you're on mm-hmm. another, I think is also really helpful because it's really, sure. really hard on online in general, just by the very nature of it, for anyone to discern tone and for anyone to discern if you're being sarcastic or if you're angry or if you're upset or if you're just, you're fine. This is just how you talk, like, which is a lot of the time just the case. But I think a mm-hmm. lot of people too, like you said, we're not necessarily like the people that we interact with are not necessarily all anonymous. At least we don't think we are. But we do still have that sort of shield of these people mm-hmm. don't know me. And yeah. at the same time, though, they think they do. We all think we know each other when we know nothing about each other.
Which apply that to Chris Carter. David
yes.
Duchovny,
Thank
Lane
you.
Anderson.
Yes.
Anyone,
yes.
anyone behind the scenes of the X-Files, apply that there. Mm-hmm. We know an aspect of them. Mm-hmm. We don't mm-hmm. know them.
We don't know the whole of any of them. And yeah, no. a lot of people seem to assume that they do. So
and I totally understand why they completely forgot all the plot points, because God knows when you're shooting 16-hour days, you know, over 6 or 7 days, like, you know, or 8 days per episode, like, of course you're not going to remember all that, because you got to memorize the lines for the next one.
Right. And then you're yeah. probably doing pickups for one that was last week. And it all probably, and they don't go home and obsess over it like we do. That would be crazy. So, yeah.
This is a job.
It's exactly. A job. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, I mean, I'm glad they've given as much of themselves as they have to yeah. the fans. But, yeah, they need to. I understand Jillian's frustrations. I understand David's frustrations. I understand Chris Carter's sort of Zen surfer dude thing where yeah. like he gives you nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. yes. You know, and like it's fascinating. Whereas like Glenn Morgan and James Wong will give you everything. Everything. Mm-hmm. Darren Morgan will make you laugh. You know, yeah. it's like mm-hmm. it's Vince Gilligan will be just, you know, very kind. You know, it's like it's it's they're all different personalities, and you know, it's just like I accept them for who they are as I see them, understanding that I do not know them in the way a friend would, in the way a spouse would, yeah. in the way no one would unless we were actually them.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
Anyway. Yeah.
I would like to hear some of your, do you have any like favorite memories of that interview, like what do you think about every once in a while? And you go, man, that really happened. Like I got that information out of them, or that happened at this incredible panel that I moderated. Like, yeah. What were your favorite bits?
Well, obviously the what the fuck is Magnetite. I mean, almost nothing can beat that. I will say, let me shout out a really lovely fan, Pat Rayner, who I don't know if you have had the chance to interact with or ever met. She is at every X-Files event. She was in the front row that day. We became friendly afterwards, and I hope she's doing okay out there. I hope she's listening to this. But I remember, this is before they got on stage, I got up and I had to give an intro. Mm-hmm. So already when it's just me on stage, I'm like, all right, keep it short and get to the chairs with them as quickly as you can. You know, so I'm like in that headspace. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to do a little joke. And so I got out there, you know, I think this will be funny. So I'll be like, hi, my name is Keith and I'm an X-Filesaholic. You know,
yeah.
And it was like, we're at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and everybody, I think a few people were like, hi, Keith. Yeah, this. Yeah. So it was good. But then I went on a little bit and I said, you know, X-Filesaholic again, or my like fellow X-Files. I don't exactly remember the context, but Pat in the front row, I recall it being her. She was like, we're called X-Files.
Oh, yeah. You're like, I know.
And I pointed at her, I was like, yes, let me never make that mistake again. I think I said or something like that. And I love that Pat did that, actually, because it did actually up my game a little bit, or up my awareness of like, right, remember that, you know, remember who you're here for.
Super fans. Yeah.
Remember what you're here to do. Mm-hmm. So I remember that moment very specifically because I was like, Pat actually shocked me into, mm-hmm. you know, because I think there was, I was starting to like slip a little bit and then she kind of shocked me back. Yep. And then I was like, okay. And then I think I just like pointed out, oh, right. And it's the day before Chris Carter's birthday and all that. And I think you'd rather see them than me right now. So yeah. And then I liked that I was able to say, you know, here are some words I never in my life thought I'd get to say. Please welcome the Styles, David Duchovny, and Gillian Anderson. Yeah. You know, and like that. And then, you know, obviously I knew I was going to go in. I'm leading off with the red Speedo.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. David, what happened to the red Speedo? And, you know, he got up and like started.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God. Right.
That was wonderful. And then I recall, and I've seen like some clips of it, and maybe that's why it's in my head, and I didn't quite see it maybe from on stage, because I couldn't, when Gillian was turned towards David, I couldn't see her reaction. But when I talked to them about their directing efforts, so David was talking about The Unnatural, and he started going off on this clip about directing Gillian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could tell from my perspective, I was like, all right,
they're having a moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Let him talk, because she's looking at him. And I think it was in a video, like, you've seen these videos where people just take footage from something and they put, like, rinky-dinky, like, romantic music over it. And it's just like, you know, and they, like, slow the image down, zoom into the eyes or something. Yeah. And it's like the moment when David is talking at Gillian and she's looking at him, and I saw her expression. And so I was like, you know, one of the nice things about this being recorded, on stage I couldn't see her expression.
Right.
But seeing it, I thought back to that moment and said, that's maybe why I have some recall of it, of just him talking about directing her and how I think it gave, I don't remember his exact thing, but it gave him a new perspective on her, on acting or something like that. And she was clearly touched.
Yeah.
Like, and he, I think he even said, you know, I've never said this to Gillian before, but blah, 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 blah. And it's like, please.
Yes, please do. Now. Yeah.
You know, go right ahead.
Perfect time.
And it was like, so that, you know, that happening, and I don't recall any moments in the panel where I felt like I was out of my element, because I knew I was gonna be up there for an hour and a half, and I was like, oh my God, am I gonna like blank at some point? And you know, actually there've been a few times on this call where it's like I've had something in my head that I want to say, and then I'm starting to talk and I digress a bit, and then because I'm thinking I'm gonna use this to build into what I want to say. But then I forget the first thing that I was going to say. And so then I'm like searching for the bit of like, what was I gonna? And I feel like there might have been a moment or two like that on the stage, but I feel like, I mean, and the way people reacted, it seemed like I recovered just fine. So,
yeah.
You know, the internal dialogue that was going on was always kind of like, oh God, oh Jesus Christ, you know. You know, but, and I ultimately, I mean, what was nice is they had me back the next year to do a Hannibal panel, which was a lot of fun too. I think the Fannibals appreciated that one too. Although, you know, I don't know to quite the same extent as X-Files, but you know,
yeah.
X-Files is kind of untouchable in that way. And then, yeah, 2014. So yeah. And then a few months later I had my gallbladder out.
You had quite a year.
I think there's this thing of like, I do Paley Center panels and then I have some vital organ or non-vital organ removed, and that is non-vital because it's vital, I wouldn't be here.
Well, but, yeah. You
know, I'm sure I'm going to have non-vital organ removed. So maybe that's why, I haven't been asked back then to do any others, but maybe I don't want to be because I don't know what else could be removed.
What else can they take out at this point?
And then the only ultimate, the other thing was the one I told you was just Jillian hugging me upstairs because that was just like,
yeah,
wow. Yeah. And I was like,
because I have a Jillian story myself. I'll tell briefly, but I wonder if she kind of maybe sensed or thought that she had made you uncomfortable or made you feel like you weren't doing a good job or something. And then maybe felt bad about that because of her laughing fit. Because of the moment when she was like freaking out laughing and everyone was loving that. But maybe in her mind, she was like, oh, what if he thinks I'm not taking this seriously, you know? And so I feel like maybe it's possible that she could have come to you and said, you know, you did a great job, or give you the hug and give you that sort of reassurance that everything was cool. Because, okay, well, briefly, I'm not going to tell the story again but when I met her briefly at a Comic-Con, I actually nearly knocked her over. And she laughed and everything was fine and we had a nice little moment. But then later in the day, I went back for like a different photo op and she remembered me, and like I was terrified in my face for like a completely different reason. But she had a moment where she came up to me and she was like, we're cool. It's okay. We're cool. Don't worry about it. Like, she thought I was still just mortified about that moment that had happened earlier. And so it just seems like she is just very much kind of tuned into that. And so... I just loved that about our interaction. And so it seems like you had a similar thing.
Yeah, no, I'm sure she has to be. I mean, from my perspective, just reading it on her face, what I gathered was that she was appreciative for how deep the panel went, because I gathered she didn't say this. This is my intuition. But I gathered that, especially when they came into the green room, I think they thought of it more of as a professional obligation than something that was going to kind of pay as much dividends as it seemed to.
Yeah.
Because I think, as we've seen, they've had plenty of moderators who, you know, don't know their shit, talk over them, you know, just kind of whatever. And you know, to whatever degree I didn't do that. And she was appreciative. So I got a sense of appreciation for being outside the norm.
Yeah. Because they probably get really tired of being asked the same things over and over again by people who clearly haven't paid attention. And it's very obvious. I think that's a reason that people love this panel so much, is that it's clear that you weren't that person. You knew what you were talking about even when they did it. And I think that was I think they enjoyed that immensely, you know. So it was just.
I certainly like to think so. David did not remember me when I went to his book signing. Of Bucky fucking Dent.
Yeah.
But it was a reading too. I do have a very, very interesting image, because I was sitting on a stool also with Pat Rayner, who I mentioned earlier, and he came up towards the edge of the crowd to read. And so he was basically right in front of me. Mm. And so I did a sort of clandestine like photo take from underneath, and you know, the dirty minded might say, why do you have an angle of David Duchovny like this? So, but he,
by the way, I'm going to need that picture. Say,
he had his,
I'm going to need that photo.
He had his clothes on, and there's nothing below the waist, but just the angle.
No, okay. Well then never mind. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean the angle. All right. Let's just say it could look like one was about to go down on David Duchovny.
We are here for it. Thank you.
Yes, but you know, I did not intend that. I was just like, oh, I'll just get a picture, and then I looked at it and I was like, whoopsie.
Did you remind him who you were and he didn't remember, or did he just not recognize you? I'm just curious.
Well, I didn't recognize. I wasn't really thinking of that. I just said, oh yeah, I hosted the Tally panel, and he's like, oh yeah, you know. I don't think he was really in the headspace to
right.
kind of, I mean, that was the thing at the Paley panel, too. I mean, you know, Julian hugged me, but after she said, oh, that was really wonderful, thank you for doing that. And David was just like, yeah, you know, that was really good.
Mm-hmm.
He has that great stoicism about him, which is what makes him perfect for, you know, Mulder and everything. And which just plays off of Julian's thing really well that she does. So, you know, it's not like, this is not me saying like I was disappointed or whatever. I mean, I got kind of what I expected.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the hug was a wonderful surprise.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh.
And so that's kind of why I think about it. And I will say that subsequent to that, I wish I had just sort of been a little more humble and stepped back and said, oh, thank you so much. That means so much to me. And kind of left it at that. I kind of talked a little more and got a little fanish. And later, you know, I made a mistake of because she was about to do Streetcar and Streetcar Named Desire for the first time. I think she was going to do it in London, and you know, she said she was rehearsing it. It's like, oh, you're playing Stella, and I mistakenly thought Stella was the lead just because Stella, but
right.
no, it's Blanche.
Right.
So, you know, I of course she's playing Blanche, and I was like, oh, you know, so I felt like an idiot. You know?
Oh, she probably was just like, oh, well, I have played a Stella, so maybe he just got mixed up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But anyway, so those are my favorite memories of the panel. Yeah.
Oh,
that's pretty good. I'm kind of glad to hear that you had kind of that sort of fanboy moment, because every single time I've ever met either David or Julian or one of my other idols, I always walk away going, oh, what did I just do? Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of glad you were not immune to that.
Yeah. Oh, no. Same thing. I mean, look, you know, it was my scared shitless pose. I mean, I was the entire time. I mean, you know, you just feel energy off of people who you consider stars, or you respect their work or whatever. It's just like, it's there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it's just like, yeah, you can succumb to that. And fortunately, I didn't do that until the very, very end, out of sight. And would only relate it on a podcast many years later.
So. Yes, yes.
Yeah, you were like super calm through the whole interview.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew obviously you must be a big fan because you were so knowledgeable, but not, sort of meeting you today, now I'm starting to grasp how big a fan you are.
Yeah.
So I'm realizing on a whole other level now the degree to which you must have been able to just sort of control yourself to be calm and not to try to sort of like blurt out too many things,
right.
but just to kind of let them have the spotlight.
Yeah. And, you know, I honestly, that's the thing. The bit of it that I've watched, I mean, I can't with my body language, you know. I mean, I'm just like, you know, I'm going like this sometimes, or like, aww. I see myself doing this, and I'm just sort of like, oh God, you know. But a lot of people in the YouTube comments that I read seemed to think it was cute. So
yeah, it was. Oh, yeah. And the good thing is that I haven't heard anyone really critical, because they're not really looking at you for the most part. They're watching
right.
David and Julian, as they should be.
Exactly.
So that's the good thing about being in an interview with the two of them, is that you know that you're the least looked at person on the stage, at least. So you have that going for you.
And very much so. So,
but that's, I mean, obviously this is probably, I mean, I think most people would say one of their favorite interviews of David and Julian ever. And also just the length of it was probably unprecedented. I mean, I can't think of another interview they did, at least prior to that. Well, they've done a couple, but like that one was just so like you said, dense. It was good questions. They had good answers. They had great chemistry. It was just such a wonderful, wonderful panel.
And you know, I mean, some people were trying to raise Twitter hell to get me on like the Comic-Con panel or wherever it was. And you know what? It wouldn't have been the same. And I think the energy there it wouldn't have been good for the Paley Center. Works because the Paley Center, I think the museum setting and kind of like the idea of like, you know, this is a show worth talking about, kind of a little bit of an exalting thing that you know, isn't just fanish.
Yeah. It's like a bunch of screaming people.
I don't want to make it seem like I'm elite talking down or something, but there is something a little bit elitist about the Paley Center that works with this.
Right.
With the kind of the pulp thing of it. I could still engage with it on that level, but there was still enough of a high toned thing that I think it was right for me to be there. I don't think I could have done it at Comic-Con because I think A, it was like only half an hour and it was more people, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's just like, I don't think you could really work up that, you know, more people on the panel. I don't know you could work up the kind of energy you needed. The fact that it was just David and Jillian.
Yeah.
You know, if it was like David, Jillian, Chris Carter, Vince Gilligan, Frank Spotnik, like that would be entirely different. I'd love to do it. Mm. But, you know, this was.
It was intimate. It was very intimate. Yeah. And like you said, that venue, I think people just by being in there realize, hey, this is not the place where I'm going to scream and shriek, yell things at them. It's just going to be kind of quiet and more professional maybe. And I don't think that's elitist to say. I think it's just different. Like it's a different, completely different environment than a con.
But what was nice, too, is that then, you know, when the laughter started and the magnetite thing, I think, really started that, then it was like, you know, okay, we're not in a museum now. We are. It's like it didn't bring it did bring it down to earth in exactly the way, you know, I hoped it would if it went well.
Yeah.
It was extreme. I mean, you know, I do remember the energy of that in the room. The energy was just like, you know, and I was like, okay, good. If we can keep going along stuff like this. And then, you know, in having them react to the certain clips and stuff, like Jillian loving Bad Blood as much as she does, mm-hmm. me deciding, I think, as I recall, they gave me the choice of what order the clips we wanted to be. And I was like, we got to do Postmodern Prometheus last. I mean, we got to end the dance scene. Yeah, that just is it. And, you know, so, you know, It worked.
Yeah, it worked. Yeah, definitely.
I loved that they were able to sort of pick and talk about their favorite moments or moments that they recalled. And even some of them, like David recalled, like, say, the how the Ghost Stole Christmas bit. Like, he recalled it slightly differently. And he was like, I didn't realize that was just kind of as funny as it was. Like, and it's like, I wonder if they really hadn't seen these clips in years. I believe it, you know? So...
If they had, because let's remember, maybe maybe to the degree that they even watched any of the things they shot, their experience of it might just be that they shot it.
Yeah.
And they remember it being filmed more than that they watched it. I would think that past a certain point, if they didn't have to watch it, it would be like, I'm almost imagining like, you know, you go and you have a board meeting at work and the board meeting is filmed and then you have to watch the film of the board meeting in addition to participating in the board meeting. And I can only think about how torturous that would be.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's much different for like someone who's acting on a show.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's like you can't really be a fan when you're involved to that degree. Mm-hmm. Even as a writer, I don't know which is why I forgive some of the narrative missteps because I think it's very easy to forget some of the narrative things, even with a show Bible.
Right.
You know,
you can still make mistakes.
Just because of the workload. And I just, you got to give, I think there's a little bit of give that one can get, that one can give to that. And especially when you can see that effort is being made.
Right.
And God knows. I don't think there's a moment on that show, you know, even Tessa Dos Bitches, even Fight Club, where there's not some kind of effort, even if it's in a negative direction, but it's like, it's effort. But anyway.
It's all earnest. It's all done out of love. I mean, you can tell that the entire show by everyone involved, like, and everyone, even all the people we've talked to who've worked on the show, like, it's just a huge labor of love. And I mean, it's really nice to see that. And so many years later, people that still just connect to this show on that level. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's nice to see all of that.
Yeah.
So tell us, you hinted earlier that you had a fun story of the first time you saw Fight the Future, I'm assuming in the theater. Please tell us that story.
Yes. So obviously June 19th, take your greatest fear and multiply it by X. That's the trailer. June 19th, 1998. So again, I was born and raised in New York. And I was like, okay, I know the X-Files movie is coming out. When the date was announced, like, I know the day and everything. And I was like, I want to do something so crazy. Now, maybe some people already know this from having watched the behind-the-scenes features on the Season 10 Blu-ray where I'm interviewed. But I saw the X-Files movie, the first one, 6 times opening day.
Wow.
You guys didn't know that.
No.
You guys didn't know that. Yeah, and Julie Eng, who does the this behind the scenes features on the later two seasons, actually put a chyron up on one of my scenes that says "Saw X-Files Fight the Future 6 times 7 again."
So. You know what? I do remember that now. I remember because that was on. Okay, it left my brain, but I remember.
Now, yes, it's insane. Let me explain some of my thinking. Up until that point, I had seen Jurassic Park in the theater 5 times total, and Breakdown, the Kurt Russell truck thriller movie, which is one of my favorite movies, 2 times in the same day. Mm-hmm. So I said to myself, I'm going to beat both my records of movie in the theater total and seeing movie in the theater in the same day. Breakdown, I can obviously beat very quickly. I see it 3 times. Great, I'm done. Jurassic Park, I've seen it 5 times. Look at this. The X-Files is opening at the Ziegfeld, which, you know, the late lamented Ziegfeld, which is no longer a movie theater. You know, big, like, huge auditorium, huge screen with a curtain that parts and everything right before. Great sound system, etc. I know it's going to be packed. I'm going to do this there. I'm going to see, and I see it's going to be playing from 10 a.m. in the morning until 3:18 the next morning. I think the last show.
Wow.
And so that's like, how many shows? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Holy shit. Okay. So I'm going to beat both my records. So.
That is impressive, man.
Obviously, like, I'm already sensing this is going to be sold out. So I got to buy my tickets ahead of time. So using my Touchtone phone from 1998. Credit card in hand, I think my mother's credit card, maybe I had my own credit card by that point, I don't know, but called into movie phone, because this is pre-internet movie phone shit,
yeah,
and ordered my 6 tickets via phone on movie phone.
Wow.
Like, you know, 3 weeks out or whatever it was, you know. So I'm set into doing this. And so then, you know, June 19th comes around. I go into the city. I go to the Ziegfeld. I make sure I get all my tickets, you know, and they are there. So they are in my hands. So I have tickets for every show of the X-Files Fight the Future, 10 a.m. in the morning until 3:18 the next morning, June 19th, 1998, at the Ziegfeld in Manhattan. I am going to do this. So the 10 a.m. show is first. So this is where it's totally fresh. You know, and like, I don't know what to expect. You know, I've seen the commercials of like, what's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. So what's great about it, the theater is probably only about half full. Mm-hmm. Because it's 10 a.m. in the morning. It's right. I will say, just to future this, to acknowledge the rest of the shows, like every other show was packed, mm-hmm. including the 1 a.m. You know, every other show in this, like, it's 1,000 seat theater.
Wow.
was packed. It's a huge theater. Mm-hmm. But 10 a.m. in the morning, you know, half full, a lot of people, but still you could feel a bit more intimacy. Mm-hmm. And so it was great to experience the movie once that way, you know, because then it's like, you know, the almost kiss scene happens. I mean, like, ah!
Yeah,
or whatever. Like,
you got 6 know, different with, reactions throughout the day
with the B and everything. You know, I was, and so, you know, and some people were saying, "Well, Keith, what if the movie's bad?" I was like, "There's no way I'm going to think this movie is bad. It is impossible. And even if it is, I'm going to go back and see it anyway." You know, it's just like, I mean, maybe if it had been just like god awful in some way, which I just couldn't conceive. I mean, it was like, you know, and so it and it wasn't. And I absolutely loved it. And then it was like, and what was great was that then I started to meet other X-Files there. And so I remember there was this one X-File girl who really into the show had never seen Piper Maru in Apocrypha. Mm. And so we were talking like all the time online about online on the computer, but like actually physically on
the line.
In line instead of just you know, we were talking in the theater about or in the line about Piper Maru and Apocrypha. You gotta see Piper Maru and Apocrypha. So the black oil is introduced to Piper Maru and Apocrypha.
Yeah.
So then though, you know, I went to every show. And the bliss of riding the wave whenever the almost came, because when you know it's coming,
yeah,
you know you're in a group of people who have this energy already
and don't know it's coming.
Everybody, which was an X-File, I think, and, you know, that they don't know it's coming. That the whole intimacy of that scene in the hallway of, you know, where it's just like, I remember in the 10 a.m. when he said, "You kept me honest, you made me a whole person." I think when he said, "You made me a whole person," I went like this in my seat, like,
yeah. I mean, that was just, yeah, that was like as intense as sex, just that.
Yeah. I mean, to describe it to people, because I don't know that they can't see this interview, I kind of just went back in my chair there and my mouth went like a gape, like,
yeah,
like that, you know, and I knocked the chair. If the chair was broken, I'd fall over. But like, you know, so all that happening, and the great thing about it is, like, as that's happening, pin drop in the theater, and you can just feel the energy that it is building inside and everything. Just like everybody is on Tinder, just like listening to every single word. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, they stop talking and, you know, they're just hugging each other, and then they like look at each other, and there's that pause, that amazing, amazing pause where Jillian is just like, you know, she's like, Scully's like looking up at Mulder. Mulder's like, you know, great stone face, and Scully is just like, well, okay, yeah, now what? Her mouth is like moving like that. Like that. And you can feel every audience, even the 10 a.m., but I was experiencing it for the first time then, but all the other five, it was just like, everybody recognized what was about to happen at the same time. And it's just this building of, as they're moving towards each other, and you can, and it first it's just a quiet energy, but then it's like, it's this sound starts to come out of people's throats.
Yeah,
and you can hear this, feel like, just louder and louder and louder. And then, right as they're about to, and then the bee hits, and it's like this. Ah!
I love it.
I wrote about this in a recent column. It was like, you know, because, you know, there's a lot of talk now about will theaters come back and everything, and the theatrical experience and this. And look, I want theaters to come back and everything, you know, but, you know, I have to say, no theatrical experience is going to beat.
Yeah.
Sitting in the X-Files movie. And knowing that effectively I was going to experience it again.
Yeah.
And again.
Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, it got to 3:18 the next morning. And, you know, I think I was there at like, you know, midnight getting on the line for the 1 a.m. show. And the girl who I talked about with Piper Maru and Apocrypha, I think she had skipped like one of the shows in between and come to the late show, and she came and she saw, he's like, "You're still here. Oh my."
I love that.
Yeah, oh, and here's a funny story. We didn't know each other at the time, but turns out my my partner slash husband, I call him my husband, even though we're not technically married, but you know, he's together since 2001, and you know, love each other dearly. He was at one of the screenings, and we didn't.
Oh, and you didn't realize it?
That's so cool.
We didn't realize each until, like, you know, when we met, like, later. We met in 2001.
Right.
We actually, this is funny, because we went to NYU at the same time, and we never met each other, and then we eventually were introduced to each other through a mutual friend. And, he told me, like, early on, like, oh, yeah, I was at that X-Files premiere day, and, you know, in 1998. It was like, oh, we didn't.
That's funny.
There's some degree to which, like, that, that there was a lot of things that was kind of a fulcrum place and moment in so many ways, and for me, and you know, I beat all of these theatrical records. I even ultimately beat it, because then after I saw it six times opening day, I saw it five more times in the theater.
Oh, wow.
Jeez, 11
times in the theater total.
Is that your record?
Wow.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it must be. Yeah, I mean, it was just a delight. And, you know, I hope too, though, I mean, in having something that felt so rare, I think it also gave me an appreciation for, you know, just the frankly, the search, the searching you do through art and through life and that you're not always going to get mm-hmm. something like that, but that you hopefully then recognize it when it comes, because I think maybe one of the problems a lot of us have sometimes is we don't recognize a good thing when we have it. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful that there are a few cases in my life, the X-Files is certainly that, I recognized how special it was having it. Recently, watching the new season of Twin Peaks every week with a group of people, you know, I knew that was going to be something special. And I mean, that's something I'll always carry with me. I don't know if that's like the ultimate lesson here, is that, you know, I hope there are more fans out there who loved the series when it existed in all its iterations, as opposed to only recognized it after the fact. And maybe for the future, I would just hope, I hope most fans can find that when you find the thing you love, that you love it deeply. And when I say love it deeply, I do not mean blindly praise mm-hmm. it to the skies.
Right.
You know, engage with it, love that you have it, appreciate it in the moment. And then, yes, mm-hmm. after the fact, if it lingers with you, because like if something lingers, and this thing certainly has, you know, but it's rare. It's rare that a work of art really has that power to linger. And I love that this one does. And I'm glad, though, that I recognized how good it was at the time. And I'm glad that as time goes on, I'm seeing, you know, because I always rewatch certain things at different times. I'm glad to see that it still has that resonance. And, you know, I think I'm fairly confident that it always will.
That's
my spiel.
Well, Keith, this was so much fun. I do want to throw out a couple quick lightning round questions for you. You already have answered your favorite episode, which was Jose Chung.
Yes.
Favorite monster?
Ooh, man. I want to go with an underrated one because he just popped into mind, because this is my pick for underrated episode. Virgil Encanto and Too Shy.
Oh, that's a great episode. Very underrated.
Yeah. Yes. Because you know, that has one of my favorite shots. The last shot of Virgil Encanto where Scully exits and it does that 180 kind of mm-hmm. into the close-up, the kind of Hannibal Lecter close-up of his decaying face.
Yeah.
I think Timothy Carhart is the actor, if I'm not mistaken, who plays Virgil Encanto. He's a kind of journeyman actor, but he's really good and makes a lot out of that. And I think that was a Jeffrey Vlaming episode. I think he wrote that in Hell Money, if I'm not mistaken.
You've got quite the encyclopedic knowledge, I must say. I am blown away by all the names that you can summon up at will.
Thank you. I mean, this is just what the show picked me. I don't know why.
It tends to do that.
But yeah, I think it's a Nutter episode too. And David Nutter, like, I think left after the middle of season 3, but I just remember it being one of those things. Not many people talk about Too Shy. And I guess it's very, you know, I guess it's very of its moment too, in the internet kind of subculture stuff, but there's still things in it that I think resonate with it. And I just think he's such a great villain in that. And I love the visual texture of that episode. And I have a lot of other great favorite villains, but I want to shout out Virgil Encanto because
I like when people do that.
You know,
yeah, that's cool.
A shout out of something a little less mentioned. I like that.
Yeah, nice.
Mythology or monster of the week?
You know, I can't pick between the two. They're both integral. Can I just say that? Because
yeah, I have a feeling you're probably going to give me the same answer in the next one. So,
we'll see. But yeah, I mean, it just, you know, they're both so absolutely necessary because, like Mulder and Scully, they play off of each other.
Right.
You know, and you know, without them, I feel like the show wouldn't be the show. So I got to say equal.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough. All right. Well, so the next question is Mulder or Scully? And with all these suitable disclaimers that we all love them both.
Yes.
If you had to pick one.
I am going to have to pick one in this case. And maybe it's because she's soon to play Margaret Thatcher, who fucks on The Crown. I'm looking, Scully. Yes. I'm looking for, you know, it's amazing that I can say, you know, anything. The thing that's driving me forward is Gillian Anderson playing Margaret Thatcher of all fucking people. I can't believe it. Yeah,
it's gonna be amazing. I cannot wait.
So yeah, I mean, also I think just because yes, Scully, but But there's just something, the breadth of what Jillian has done subsequent and within is so amazing. And I'm just like amazed by her. So, yeah.
Oh, well, that's nice. A great answer.
No offense, David. I love you. But yeah, I
got to pick
Jillian.
We have to pick. We're forcing you to pick, so it's okay. It's okay.
I understand. Yeah.
And the last question, perhaps the most important one.
Yes.
Platonic partners or soulmates?
I mean, come on. Soulmates.
Again.
Yeah, despite what the field where I died said, you know, I mean, but that's Morgan and Wong. Morgan and Wong have a different take on things.
You got to listen to our episode we just did about The Field Where I Died. We have not dropped it yet. Maybe we will have by the time this is playing. But yes, we went all over on that one.
And no offense to Kristen Cloke, who's great in that episode. And I love her generally, like as Laura Means on Millennium too. And obviously she's Mrs. Glenn Morgan. So, and wrote and co-wrote Followers. Yes. So, you know, I mean, but yeah, soulmates.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. Agree. So, soulmates, great answer.
We like that answer.
From frame one, day one. So,
yeah.
Nice.
Yep. Absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, Keith, thank you so much for coming on. This was a lot of fun. I know you're not on social media anymore. So, I don't know what, but is there anything you'd like to plug?
The only social media, such as it is Letterboxd. You can find me there. I would just say type my name. Even if you misspell it, it's like unique enough that I think we'll redirect you to Keith Hulick. I'll just spell K-E-I-T-H. Last name is U-H-L-I-C-H. Mm-hmm. Keith Hulick. If you type it into Google, you'll find things like my personal site, my Letterboxd account, a lot of the places that I've written for Slant Magazine, Time Out New York, Hollywood Reporter. They tend to all come up in that way. My Substack is where I'm mostly kind of focusing on. I'm doing some things, like I'm doing an X-Files project there that I had started as a Tumblr and I'm redoing, called X-Files One Shot, where I get a single shot from each episode and I kind of write a little mini essay about it.
Nice.
Also added some things to it now, because originally it was just the one shot and some text. But sometimes there's so many images, and I just do also this section called After Images in the post, which also includes like other shots from the episode where I just have like a one line like pithy comment about it or something. But like I'm just trying to think of one, like in the pilot, I did the one of the smoking man. Well, when they're doing the regression hypnosis on
Billy Miles,
and it's Heitz Werber doing it, and Mulder's in behind the glass, and then there, you see behind the glass, it's like Blevins and the smoking man and Scully, and it goes around, and you see everyone like in the shot, and at the same time, it's like shadowy in the foreground, and then very bright in the background. And you know, and I kind of write about how I think there's so much about this shot that explicates the show. And that's what's fascinating to me, is that I think the glass is one way, so it's sort of like Scully can see Mulder, but Mulder, if you were to look through the glass, you would see his reflection. It's never entirely confirmed, but I think that it's like reflective glass on Mulder's side. And there's a shot later that happens where Mulder turns to look at Scully, and Scully can see him. But if it's a one-way glass, it's kind of like, I don't think that Mulder can see Scully literally.
Right.
So what it is it's, but he connects
with
her
on anyway.
Eyeline level.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like there's this, it shows his intuitiveness. Like he has this supernatural intuitiveness, and the fact that she literally sees him, you know, speaks to her groundedness.
Yeah.
In scientific.
Wow. And so that's deep. You know, I love it.
Just
nice.
Even like right there in the pilot, their relationship is visually explicated in a very implied way. So it's kind of like, you know, like that shot, I kind of like lead into like a discussion of that and how I think it sets the tone for the series going forward. So.
And that's a Tumblr. Cool. What's the name of the Tumblr?
Well, it was a Tumblr. The Tumblr was X-Files One Shot, but now I've moved that project to my Substack.
Oh,
which,
okay.
It's all parentheses.
I'll have to find that one.
And nice. I started again, but the Tumblr is still up. And the Tumblr I got up to, I got up to .com, and then for whatever reason I dropped off. I think life interfered. And right now I'm only up to. I've done up through Jersey Devil, and I'm up to Ghost in the Machine. So like I'm moving slow.
What's
sorry, I don't do it each week, but you know, I mean, I'm getting there, and I actually do want to really follow through on this. It's just sometimes it takes a little more work, and I have to focus on other things sometimes too. So
sure,
yeah, but yeah, cool. That's there.
I'm gonna have to check that out.
Yeah, definitely.
This was a lot of fun. Thanks so much. We're gonna have to have you come back and like chat about an episode or something because this was a lot of fun.
I'd love to. Yeah, obviously you can see I could talk till the cows come home. Yeah, so
that's all good.
We can too. Well, thank you so much for listening, you guys. That was a really, really fun and interesting conversation. I really enjoyed talking to Keith. You guys check us out at XFD Podcast on Twitter. Let us know what you think of the conversation. What were your guys' favorite parts of that Paley conversation? Because we all have them. I know.
We did.
But thanks for listening, and we will see you on the next episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.